Hello, and welcome to episode 266 of Some Like It Scott. I'm your host, Scott Harvey, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Scott Shelton. Today on the podcast, we harness the power of the desert once again in our review of the sci-fi sequel, Dune, Part 2. But first, how are you, Scott?
I'm great. I'm doing great. I did recognize that at some point the last couple days, actually when I was walking in to see Dune for the first time, that prior to that, I'd seen about like two movies in February. And technically, Dune didn't even come out in February. I did see it in February, but that was like a little bit of a weird moment for me. But I really think of it after having watched Dune Part 2 as I wasn't tainting my February with lesser movies like Madam Web, and I don't even know what else came out in February.
Driveaway Dolls, maybe?
Dolls. To be fair, I am interested in catching Driveaway Dolls. Yeah. I just haven't had the time.
It's getting very mid-reviews, but yeah.
It is getting mid-reviews. That is true. The Coens need to come together to make movies, not apart. Although some people really enjoy Tragedy of Macbeth a few years ago. Anyway, I shouldn't have tainted my February experience for the sanctity and purity of the religious experience of Dune Part 2. And look, I'm not disappointed with that. And that is why I'm doing great, because I've seen Dune Part 2. I have been led to paradise by Muad'Dib, and I'm here
have
to talk about
it. Twice
it I have seen it twice, yes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, no, this is normally the type of thing where we'd say, okay, movies are back, right? We got the first big one, let's go.
Yeah.
But as we were just talking about before we started recording, Scott, this is kind of it for a little bit. And, you know, even the big theatrical releases which are coming up in the next month or two are Ghostbusters, you know, the umpteenth sequel, the umpteenth Godzilla versus Kong movie. Not really the stuff that is going to get you going the way that that this movie does. Not until Furiosa, which is, you know, more than 2 months away at this point. Although seeing that trailer in IMAX before
makes
Dune
you think.
Part 2. Yes.
Makes you think maybe we're so back.
Maybe we are. Yeah. I think those are the two movies to save us for sure. But yeah, I'm good as well, Scott. I did have a mild crisis when I went to see this movie because I had purchased my ticket a long time ago for IMAX when tickets first went on sale, and I got to the theater and my ticket was not scanning. And, you know, the two or three times that's happened to me before, it's because, you know, I have bought it for the wrong theater or something. And so I was worried because I was already in Concord, which is about 25, 30 minutes north of Charlotte, because that's the nearest IMAX. But it turns out I had bought the ticket for Friday. And, you know, the theater was packed, like it's opening night. I was like, there's no chance that there's any tickets still left. I mean, it was right before the movie. So I went over to the ticket desk and I assumed that they were just going to laugh at me. But the guy showed me the screen.
Said,
there was about
one for Dune Part 2, please.
Yeah. Just stared them down. The guy showed me the screen. There was about 8 seats left. Of course, most of those were the front 2 rows. But then there happened to be like one seat, like row H11, not even kidding, like middle row of the theater, almost like just slightly to the right of dead center. Like I almost could not have picked a better seat for myself. I don't know how that seat was not bought, but it was available. And then actually nobody sat in the seat to the left of me either, even though the theater was, you know, it was full as the screen suggested, but was very happy. I think, you know, maybe some sort of Bene Gesserit powers or something were assisting me in managing to get a ticket at such a late juncture, and for it to be such an advantageous seat as well was prime.
It's very possible. Yeah, it's look, trust me, I know all about it. It's hard to get a ticket to Dune on opening night because the 3:15 a.m. screenings at Lincoln Square are sold out. So it's very challenging.
I did notice that going around on Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
The real sickos are out.
Yeah, there's a funny tweet that I saw, and maybe this is one that you saw as well, where it's like watching Dune Part 2 and then walking out to see the sunrise must be such a strange experience.
I assume that's just like all the Fremen who are going to see the movie at 3:15 a.m. You know, that would check out, I think.
But they're the real fans.
Yeah. All right. Well, Scott, we're dancing all around it. We might as well get into the big movie, which is Dune Part 2, the much anticipated sequel to Denis Villeneuve's 2021 epic, which once again adapts the iconic sci-fi novel by Frank Herbert.
You meant Part Sandwalk. Two. We're dancing around it, but we're sandwalking around it.
Yes, you can't see it, but we are doing that. Part two picks up precisely where part one left off, with Timothy Chalamet's Paul Atreides and his mother, Lady Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson, having escaped the Harkonnens' attack at Arrakeen and fleeing to the desert, where they've joined the indigenous Fremen people. The Fremen are bitterly divided over what significance, if any, Paul's arrival might hold. Some, like Javier Bardem's Stilgar, believe that Paul may be their Messiah, the much prophesied about Lisan al-Ghaib. But many of the younger members of the Fremen, including Chani, played by Zendaya, believe this myth is nothing more than a way of controlling the masses, even as she finds herself drawn closer to Paul and his seemingly unexplainable abilities. At the same time, Lady Jessica is invested in her own messianic prophecy, as she believes Paul to be the Kwisatz Haderach, the male Bene Gesserit super being, and is happy to accept the role of Reverend Mother to the Fremen in order to see this prophecy play out. Meanwhile, the Emperor, played by Christopher Walken, who orchestrated the attack on Arrakeen, is frustrated by the Harkonnen's failure to control spice production, and along with his daughter Irulan, played by Florence Pugh, and the Reverend Mother Helen Mohiam, played by Charlotte Rampling, plots to unleash Baron Harkonnen's psychopathic nephew, Fade Rautha, played by Austin Butler, to quash the Fremen and their new leader, Paul. As Arrakis heads towards another war, Paul will come face to face with his own destiny and have to decide whether to embrace the prophecies encircling him or to forage his own path outside the creations of myth. Scott, does Villeneuve's follow-up to his Oscar-winning epic provide a blockbuster spectacle for the ages, or does the sheer task of trying to adapt Herbert's weighty work finally overcome the great director?
Yeah, it's the former. It really is. I don't mean to be arrogant about this, but I was realizing in the days leading up to this that I just really had absolutely no doubt that Villeneuve was going to do something on par with the first. I wasn't nervous at all. Obviously, the initial reviews, frankly, were crazy. That's a whole separate thing. Like, it feels like every single person who saw Dune Part 2 early, like 2 weeks ago, was like, this is the greatest movie of all time.
Correct. David Ehrlich's review was crazy. It really was.
Well, no, David Ehrlich's review was not 2 weeks ago. David Ehrlich's review was more recent than that. But
yeah,
I'm talking about the people who first saw the movie who were saying, like, this is Empire Strikes Back. This is all these things. I don't even really particularly care to compare the movie to those other great sequels. This is a great sequel to a movie. And I was just thinking about it, and I'm like, I don't really feel like I have any reason to be nervous with Arrival, with Blade Runner 2049, with Dune Part 1. And when I sat down in the chair to watch the movie, I wasn't nervous. And as soon as the opening scene starts, as soon as you get to the point where the Harkonnen sort of soldiers are climbing up the mountain ridge, I'm just like, this is it. Like, he's doing it again. And I felt that way from that point to, you know, the very end of the movie where, you know, Chani is going to ride a sandworm. And it's just an incredible feat of cinematic filmmaking. It really is. It's every bit as grand, if not even more so, than the first film. I think sort of the epicness of the film is ratcheted up in part two, but the production value and production quality is right there. Tons of adaptive choices made in this thing. Scott, I know you have not read, right? Okay. Yeah. I didn't think you had. There's tons of adaptive choices that change this in some ways very significantly, much more significantly than the first film from the book. And I don't know if it's worth talking about those things, but maybe we can touch briefly on it at the end, especially certain ones. Some of those choices, I think, are specifically designed to make the film watchable. I think we talked about that in our review of the first part of Dune, where he, like, Villeneuve and Spates and Eric, I think, I can't remember the third, there was a third person who co-wrote the first
Eric
film.
Roth did write the first one.
Okay, it was Eric Roth. Okay, that's what I thought. Okay. There were choices made in the first adaptation to that I think made the film more watchable, more accessible, removing some of the sort of intricacies of the politics and the bureaucracy in exchange for something that's a little bit more action focused and grounded, making it more this sort of sci-fi adventure. And I thought those were all very wise choices adaptively. And I'd say Villeneuve doubles down a lot in making sure the adaptive choices he's making make the film much more watchable. There's so much action in this movie, way more so than I was expecting. The book has, you know, a lot more of the dramatic quality between Paul and Chani, Paul and Lady Jessica. There's just a lot more conversations that are happening in the film or in the book. But nevertheless, like, I can't help but feel when I, you know, when I think about the film, when I watch it, the choices that Villeneuve makes to sort of develop a lot of those relationships in the medium of these sort of grand action set pieces, even earlier on when they're, you know, fighting the sort of spice harvester, you know, they're attacking the spice harvesters. I think all of those adaptive choices are in favor of the film just being really enjoyable to consume in the visual medium. And obviously, I mean, we even talked about it in our episode last week about his Villeneuve's whole notion that, you know, there's too much dialogue, or the dialogue of TV is sort of poisoning the medium of cinema in some ways. And I think you can sort of see that a little bit, where he wants to take some of that development that happens via conversation in the book, and how can he make that development happen more visually on the screen? And the way that it happens is through these sort of the bonding that takes place through these different set pieces that he creates that are maybe just implied in the book as opposed to there. And I think all that is in favor of like an absolutely grand experience. I mean, Hans Zimmer is once again murdering some interns to get this thing done, I think, fair to say. Yeah, exactly. He is doing some crazy stuff once again. And Greg Fraser has now, like, I don't know, every film he's done over the last 3 or 4 years. But the ones that I remember is that he's done Dune Part One, The Batman, The Creator, which has its flaws, but certainly was not flawed cinema in terms of its cinematography, and Dune Part Two. And the guy sort of really feels like he's creating his own cinematic language via IMAX that is pretty much only rivaled by Hoyte van Hoytema at this point, it really feels like, in terms of like large format screen experiences. And that, you know, that's not the be all the end all of the theatrical experience. But I think for a film like this, you know, there's just some extremely memorable shots in this movie, and it's pretty incredible. And when you layer that on top of the production design of the film, I mean, just to throw out, just in case it doesn't come up later, like what they do on, I forget the name of the planet right now, I think it's Gedi Prime, which is the Harkonnen planet with the black sun and bleeding into like a black and white format when you're outside, and the sort of the ink fireworks. That's the only way I can describe it, like ink blot fireworks. I mean, just that's just an example of incredible production choices that, you know, are small things that maybe not everyone's going to talk about that sort of took my breath away in the film. And to say that it lived up to Dune Part One is the least I think we can start to talk about this film.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned when I went into Dune Part One, or, you know, we talked about it in our review, that I was a Dune virgin at the time. I had no sort of basis in anything related to Dune, hadn't read the book, never seen the Lynch film, you know. I was coming in completely cold, and, you know, I was blown away. I found it an incredibly compelling cinematic experience, and not difficult to follow as I had feared. And I think I would say the exact same about this sequel, even though I'm, you know, I guess I'm not a Dune virgin anymore because I've at least seen the film, but I haven't seen or I haven't read the book. I don't know this part of the story. And, you know, I did rewatch the movie, but I was still a little, you know, concerned at the back of my mind going in, like, okay, there was like a lot of complicated, you know, words and places and stuff in here. Am I going to, like, you know, not be able to follow what's going on? And I mean, I was even joking, like, on Letterboxd, oh, this movie's about whether this guy is the Lisan al Gaib or the Kwisatz Haderach. You know, there's like, he has his own language that Frank Herbert invented. And it's like, if you go walk up and say that to somebody on the street, they're going to be like, what the hell are you talking about? But when you watch the movie, it all makes sense. Everything makes sense. I think the story is compelling, and it's also easy to follow, right? Like, you know, you have these sort of competing messianic prophecies. You have this political struggle essentially that's going on between the emperor and the Harkonnens and the Fremen. You have, you know, this sort of rich commentary on like power dynamics, and Paul starting to have this power as being this messianic figure and kind of debating how he wants to harness it exactly, which I think is, you know, very compelling to watch play out. It's gripping. The entire story is gripping. And I think that's the first thing I would shout out, because you know, there's so much in blockbuster storytelling nowadays that is, you know, recycled and tropey and, you know, oh, we have to go get this one thing so we can go to the other place, you know, just all MacGuffins and stuff like that. And you never feel that with Dune Part Two. You're immediately immersed in this world. Like you said, pretty much from the beginning, you know, we open up with Princess Irulan doing her diary, but then right after that, we're right into an action scene, which is the one that you're referencing. But
yeah, and Princess Irulan whole diary thing, that is a construct of the in the book that's in every chapter. So you're sort of introduced. Okay. You don't know who she is at first, but obviously later in the book, it becomes clear who these diary entries are. But she has a diary entry that sort of opens the beginning of every chapter. So I was surprised they didn't have that in the first movie, and I'm glad Florence Pugh's in this movie. Irulan's an important character, maybe not in this movie, but if there is a Dune Part Three, she will be a very important character.
Sure.
And it was nice to see that touch sort of like added back into the film, and obviously like the fact that she has any scenes at all with the Emperor, with the Reverend Mother, like that's not in the book. None of that stuff is in the book.
And the other thing about the story, too, is, you know, I've had this issue, you know, issue. I say issue lightly. It's I don't even know if it's an issue or not. But we talked about it with Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse last year, of this whole we're going to end in media race. Right. Like, and, you know, we're really just setting up the third movie. Yes, of course, there, you know, the aspirations are certainly for a third Dune film to conclude the trilogy. But this movie never feels like it is just spinning its wheels until we are getting to the third, you know, to the third movie. It feels like we're actually working towards something that has an endpoint, right? And, you know, yes, there's probably going to be spinoffs and stuff like that. Maybe they come out of this, but that was some of my concerns with Spider-Verse, is like, can we not just have a story that, you know, has a beginning, middle, and end? Does it always have to keep going and keep going, keep going until it eventually becomes a snake eating its own tail and is just, you know, it's just continuing to exist for marketing reasons. I don't see the Dune going down that path. I think Villeneuve, you know, has a story that he wants to tell. I think this is part of that story. And I think Dune Messiah, if he gets to make it, which I think he probably will, is going to be the conclusion of that. And so I really appreciated that from a storytelling perspective as well. And, you know, obviously you've mentioned the technical aspects. I don't want to just, you know, harp on those over and over again, because they obviously are spectacular. I do want to mention, of course, the performances are also great. I think across the board,
yeah.
You know, again, part of the trouble, I think, with adapting this is, you have so many moving parts, right? You have the Emperor and what's going on there. You have the Harkonnens and their whole deal. You have the Fremen. You have Paul Atreides and Gurney and these people from the, you know, Atreides household, basically. The ones that are left, at least. You have a lot of different groups of people. You have a lot of different areas of this world. You have a lot of different stories that you have to cover in 2 hours and 45 minutes. And you need compelling actors in every single part of that so that it's not like, hey, oh, we're going to the Harkonnens now. Well, I'm going to go to the bathroom because I don't really care about this. There's not that segment of the movie. And I had to go to the bathroom right as the movie was starting. And I was like, crap.
Yeah.
Didn't go. I just didn't go.
That's my guy. That's my guy. He held it.
45 minutes. I was locked in. And that, I mean,
honestly, I feel like listeners, we have, that is a big deal. That is a big deal.
I forgot that I had to go. I literally did. Like, that's the type of movie that it is. And of course the IMAX experience, it just envelops you. Like I was talking to you, Scott, about, you know, I don't see a lot of movies in IMAX just cause it's not as convenient for me.
Yeah.
But I like literally my teeth I could feel the sound in my teeth at times.
When I saw this movie at Lincoln Center, the bass, and this is a nice theater. I don't know if we've seen a movie together in this theater, but it's like their main theater.
We've been to Lincoln Square, but not to the IMAX. Yeah.
No. I'm talking about at Lincoln Center. So at Lincoln Center, like the indie film house, I saw this film there. And in their main theater, so not the, they use a separate event space for the New York Film Festival at Juilliard, but like their main theater, which is a very nice theater, just in terms of like quality of the projection and quality of the sound. I've always had a really great experience there, but the sound is so intense in this film, to your point, that it was actually, I think, not literally breaking, but it was like sort of breaking the design of the theater, where you could hear the rattle. And I've never heard that before. That, like, you can hear the speakers rattling and the intensity of the bass and things like that.
It's something to behold for sure. And I would recommend, you know, seeing this on the biggest screen that you can. It is certainly that type of movie. But as I was saying, I think the performances, you know, they keep you hooked to every single part of the story, whether it's, you know, the returning members of the cast. I mean, I think we'll get into Timothée Chalamet here in just a moment, but I think he's phenomenal in the lead role. I think it's one of his best performances, if not his best performance of his young career. And this movie makes, you know, again, we talked about it a little bit with Timothée Chalamet when we talked about Wonka and how, oh, the movie star may not be dead or whatever. I mean, you got four people really in this movie between Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Florence Pugh, and Austin Butler. And you look at all four of them and it's like, we're going to be fine. Like we got movie stars. And all four of them, I think, are cooking here. But, you know, the other cast members as well, of course, I think Rebecca Ferguson has a lot to do here as Lady Jessica, and is a very complex figure. And I think she nails all the layers of that. It just, you know, it's top down. It's top to bottom. It's a incredible production. And I find there are maybe a few nitpicks which I can raise, but honestly, I find it hard to criticize very much about the movie. We had to wait a little bit longer for it, but whatever they did in that interim, you know, it was certainly worth the wait. I think this is, it's definitely one of the best blockbusters in many years. And, you know, time will only tell whether it deserves comparison to something like The Empire Strikes Back and stuff like this. But certainly when you watch this today, it's like, and you compare it to where Star Wars is today, it's like, I mean, it's no competition, right? I mean, there may be no competition, maybe Mission Impossible, maybe John Wick, but I don't even really think so. I think Villeneuve has come out of the gate with 2 5-star.
I mean, those are such different movies, right? Like those are, it's hard to, I mean, this is an action movie. I understand that it is an action
in
movie.
In the sci-fi realm, yeah.
But it's not like Mission Impossible or John Wick, in my opinion. Like I don't, that those films don't really cross my mind. I mean, maybe John Wick crosses my mind
from a world building perspective. Yeah.
No, I was going to say from a like just purely from the final combat, like climactic combat scene between Paul and Fade Rautha, that scene does remind me a little bit more of something extremely kinetic, like John Wick. But I mean, besides that, it's really hard to compare those movies in my head. I'm not thinking about either of those films when I'm watching this movie.
Yeah. All right, Scott, let's move on and talk about the cast of this movie.
Yeah.
It is vast and filled
and
with
mighty.
recognizable names. Let's start at the top. Timothée Chalamet playing Paul Atreides. You know, I think when he was originally cast, there's some people that were just saying, oh, this is just trendy casting. You know, he is the guy right now. They're just getting him to sell tickets. Do you think that bears out here, or do you think he more than holds down the role of Paul Atreides, the central figure in Dune?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think he more than holds, like, more than holds down the role. And there was a pull quote from an interview that Villeneuve gave when the first film came out, where he said he would not have made Dune if Timothée Chalamet did not accept the role of Paul Atreides. He just wouldn't. He would have passed and moved on. And that sounds very hyperbolic, maybe coming out of the first movie, where Chalamet does a great job in the first movie too, don't get me wrong. but feels a bit hyperbolic. And then I think you hit this movie, and whether it's sort of like Villeneuve and Chalamet like manifest this notion, or whether this was it from the start, right? You really feel and understand why Villeneuve felt so strong, like what he saw in this casting and why he was so adamant that it was Chalamet or bust on this. And frankly, you know, for Chalamet himself, like this is sort of the real, in my opinion, like even with stuff like Little Women and other, some of the smaller indie projects he's done, like this is his first true show of how much juice he has in the acting department since Call Me By Your Name. Like it really does feel that way for me. And not only is he really acting and giving such a bravura performance here, he's doing it in a way that, you know, even with something like Call Me By Your Name, you don't see this kind of performance in him until he does it on the screen. And the sort of the places he goes from a character perspective and from, you know, a sort of like, you know, forceful charisma perspective in the third act of the film is really arresting in the movie. And you feel the pain of his struggle and to you know, trying to avoid going south in the desert, trying to avoid this future that he has visions of. And he feels, at conflict with this notion of him wanting revenge against the Harkonnens, against the Emperor. And I feel like you see him wrestling both externally and internally with a lot of those notions in the movie. And then when he goes south, when he finally does go south and he does sort of embrace the, we'll say, you know, the devil on his shoulder, so to speak, going south and doing what must be done is the way he puts it in the movie. When he finally sort of accepts that he must go south, he, you know, how quickly and violently he falls into that path is something that really, it's hard to imagine too many other actors being able to go on that journey in that way. Even other people in this cast, like Austin Butler, who I think does an amazing job as Fade Rautha, who we'll talk about in a second. Like, you know, you can't, I don't know if I can picture Austin Butler going on that same journey. You know what I mean? And it really feels like a singular performance. And obviously, what, he's like our age, basically. He's like 28, 29. He has 40 to 50 years in his career left if he wants to. But I think this is going to be a movie up there with Call Me By Your Name that really puts him like sort of permanently on the map as an actor. And I know that he was very popular in other films, and maybe you could point to those as well as to growing his popularity, but this feels like a milestone in his career.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, you're right. There's some scenes where I was like, I didn't really know that he had this in him. I mean, he's not a physically imposing guy, right? He has this boyishness about the way that he looks and everything. Totally. You don't think of him as being intense or...
I mean, they sort of make a joke about that in the first film when Jason Momoa's character tells him, makes fun of him for like not being very like built, mm-hmm. you know, muscularly.
Yeah, early on in the movie. Yeah. But he has to go to some interesting places in the third act of this movie. And the command that he has of the screen, I think, is something that we haven't really seen him do before in this particular way. I mean, some of the scenes where he's addressing these large crowds of Fremen, right? And he is, you know, this is him. He's their messianic figure, and he has to show that off. It's, you know, there's a lot going on there. Like, again, he's commanding. It's also scary almost in a way. Like, I think he taps into that part of the character really effectively because, you know, I think minds may differ on this. I don't think the movie is explicit and necessarily in its commentary on power and power dynamics, but there is something scary about the way that he, you know, sort of just gives in to the prophecy. Maybe he doesn't even believe it, right? That's kind of the scary thing. Maybe he doesn't even believe it himself, but he does it because it's advantageous for him and it's what could get him what he ultimately wants, right? That's revenge, possibly, as you've alluded to. And
whether he believes it or not is such an interesting it is almost like an irrelevant question to your point, yeah. because it doesn't matter whether he believes the prophecy or not. What he's doing is he's using, just like his mother, right, throughout the whole film, just like Jessica, Lady Jessica is. Yeah, he's using this prophecy that I think we can question what it may, I mean, the film questions what is a prophecy in general? What does that mean? And he's using that to his advantage to, you know, basically to create an army to exact his own personal revenge, to your point.
Yeah, it makes you think about just, you know, real life political power dynamics.
100%.
Who have risen to power and the
means. It was relevant 60 years ago when Frank Herbert wrote the book and was questioning the, you know, the moral quandary of, you know, religious fanaticism and messianic figures. And that hasn't changed in 60 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot to chew on. And I think Timothée Chalamet, like I said, he taps into every single part of this character and goes to some darker places that I don't think we've seen from him before. And I was all the way in. I think, you know, if anyone had doubts for him as being like a talented actor, like he's kind of a meme guy at this point, like, oh, who's Timothée Chalamet dating? Like, oh, you know,
sure.
Here he is at the Lakers game with Kendall Jenner or whatever, Kylie Jenner. I don't even know which one it is, but, you know, here's the Grammys and he's there and Taylor Swift and Selena Gomez are gossiping about him, whatever. No, amidst all of that, he's a really great
just actor. To be clear, it's Kylie Jenner, I'm pretty sure, if we want to just get that out of the way.
Literally could not care less. But amidst all of that, he's a really great actor, and I hope that doesn't get lost amongst his, like, sex symbol status. This movie proves it. I mean, I've been in on him for a long time, but I think this movie proves it more than
you're ever. Like, I was there on day one, brother, Interstellar.
Hot Summer Nights.
Now look, that's a movie I try to forget every day.
No. But I mean, I think I've obviously been all the way in since Little Women. Like, I do think his performance in there is, you know, a lot better than even people may be given credit for. But this is a whole new level. And he's a movie star. There's no denying it. Anyone who tries to tell you there's no movie stars, they're forgetting about him.
I think the thing with Little Women is that he's just doing the same. He's kind of doing the same performance. It's a different flavor of the same performance, sure. But he's just doing the same performance.
Yeah, he's not going as, to.
Yeah, as Call Me By Your Name, as sort of insert like emotionally, you know, torn, you know, late teen, you know, young adult, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he is emotionally torn in Dune, don't get me wrong, but he's not going in, you know, killing the Harkonnens and Little Women.
Yes, he is not. Scott, as mentioned, the supporting cast is huge in this movie. Yeah. We don't have time to talk about every single person in the supporting cast as much as we might like to.
Sure.
I'll just throw it to you to start. You know, do you want to call out a few people who stood out to you? It's hard because I think everybody stands out in certain scenes, but if you had to give your flowers to two or three people, who would you call?
Yeah, no, it is really tough to pick. I gotta say, like, I'm just scanning down the cast list here, and every single person that has a bullet point entry on the Wikipedia page and the cast list, I'm like, yeah, they all did a really good job. But to highlight a couple, because I thought she was such an important part of the first film, and I think maybe even an underrated way. One of the things that I feel like I'm starting to see more and more people talk about how locked in her performance was is Rebecca Ferguson. I think she's someone that we've been a big fan of from the start of her career. Something I didn't realize, that I didn't realize that Mission Impossible Rogue Nation was like one of the first movies that she did as an actress.
Yeah.
Not something that I realized until recently. So, but yeah, anyway, Dune Part 2 here. She takes this character who felt like such a interesting motherly figure. Like, there was always something more going on with her. I think that's clear in Dune Part 1 because of her Bene Gesserit ties. She obviously loves her family very much. She loves Paul very much. And she this character of Lady Jessica has to act in such a defensive position in Dune Part One, that she's very reserved, she's very deferential in many respects in Dune Part One, and I think that was a really important part of the beginning of this journey through the film, and to see how that character switches gears in Part Two and becomes this very imposing, almost very more offensive, more deranged character in Part Two, as she sort of steps into her part of the, you know, quote unquote prophecy, and takes the water of life, and then of course becomes Reverend Mother and has this very less covered relationship with her unborn daughter than the book plays out, but it's still there. Like, I think the commitment to being a crazy person in this film is admirable, and I every single scene between her and Timothy Chalamet, I just think is amazing. Like, honestly, I think their relationship, the way they talk to each other, the way that they interact with each other, is just brilliant in my mind. It's one of the best parts. And I just think that she deserves a lot of the credit that I think she's starting to get for this sort of bigger performance that she gives in this movie, because it is a very big performance. It's a very physical performance in its own right, which I think is a big, I think it's something that we sort of know that she's capable of. I mean, she's giving like nothing but physical performances in Mission Impossible, of course. So I think it's cool to see her start getting credit. On the other side of the psycho spectrum, Austin Butler playing Fade Rautha, I think it's like, maybe it's very easy to point to it, and sort of like the whole like Empire Strikes Back comparisons. I just like find the whole like he is the next Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight thing just like kind of silly. Not because his performance isn't amazing. I do genuinely think the performance is amazing, but like the character of Fade Rautha is just not asked to do what the character of the Joker is asked to do in The Dark Knight, and is inherently limited. Is he an incredibly memorable villain who I don't think I'm going to forget for a while? That is definitely true. But the sort of all the comparisons I saw to like him being like Heath Ledger's Joker, I just thought was like strange, and very knee-jerk reaction-y of a type. But you know, with the sort of the craziness of that comparison aside, I did think that I know it's like talk about big meme guy energy, like the voice, man, when he talked for the first time and he sounded like a freaking Skarsgård, like he sounded like he could be Stellan Skarsgård's son, I was like, oh my god, that's
he's
crazy.
He's not using the voice, but he is using a voice for sure.
Yeah, he's a voice guy. First off, Austin Butler, famous voice guy now.
Yeah,
from his Elvis voice to this, but like genuinely, Scott, like it sounds like I'm making a joke, but I was like genuinely shocked that he made himself sound like he could be the son of Stellan Skarsgård. And as soon as that happened, I was like, it's kind of a bit of a joke, but it's like I was locked in. I was like, the commitment on this to do that and sound like you are the son of, I mean, I know he's this like nephew technically or whatever, but he's making himself sound like Stellan Skarsgård, like, you know, Rabin, like all these other Harkonnens that we've met sort of tangentially. And then to go on and give the sort of physical performance that he does is remarkable. And I briefly mentioned the final scene of the film earlier on, but just to talk about that for a second, like the physicality of that really feels like its only equal that I've seen recently is something like something out of John Wick. I mean, the fact that they have those sort of knife fight scenes hold for as long as they do, and there's not some sort of like completely chaotic cutting going on and editing through that, the physicality of that's like unbelievable. And I think you start to understand, like, all these people who are just like, I want my like crazy lightsaber battles from Star Wars. And I don't really want to get into that discussion. But like, the reason why I feel like people are just like, that's it, when they like see these fights, is that like those kind of fights don't last very long. It's so hard to maintain that level of physical intensity. You just look at like boxing matches and, you know, MMA and things like that. Like, it's really, they're like breaking up like every few seconds because it's very hard to maintain that level of intensity. And I just think the final fight scene in this movie, the physicality that Austin Butler and Timothy Chalamet show in that scene is like unbelievable to me. I think that's like one of the coolest hand-to-hand combat scenes we've gotten, you know, in years. It doesn't really immediately come to me off the top of my head what I'd put over it. You know, it's on par with some of the scenes from John Wick, no doubt about that. So I thought Austin Butler was awesome. Really excited to see him and the Bike Riders later this year, finally, as well. Another film that got delayed out of last year. Austin Butler could have had a crazy year last year, but he just sort of got denied it by the strikes. So that's the two that I'd call out. I know I talked a lot about them. I do think that Javier Bardem maybe is the third person that I'd cite. And I was, you know, we were joking a little bit about this before we started recording, but this film has a lot of humor. Like this might, I was thinking about this and I think I heard someone say it on Twitter that like, this might be Denis Villeneuve's like funniest film. There's quite a bit of humor.
I was going to say, I think we have to couch that a little bit. I would not say that it has a lot of humor. I think it has.
It has more humor than you'd expect.
Humor. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has more humor than you'd expect. And it is not disrupting. It's not, this is a good point to make. This is not like a comic book movie humor that we're talking about here.
No,
like,
I was going to make that point. Yeah.
The narrative is not being the emotional beats are not being disrupted by crass jokes. And in many ways, the humor of this film, not always the case, but sometimes, especially with Stilgar, the humor is actually being used thematically, right? Like he's saying things about Paul, about the Lisan al-Ghaib, about the prophecy that sound like a joke, that are easy to laugh at.
Like but Paul when, denies.
I was going to say,
when Paul denies that he's the Lisan al-Ghaib, and he's just like, that's exactly what the Lisan al-Ghaib would
say. Humble. He's so humble.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are genuinely funny. They're very funny moments. And then at the end of the film, when this holy war begins, you ask yourself, how funny is all of that now? Because that's only possible because of the sort of fanaticism that seems like a joke earlier on in the movie. And I think I personally think that's brilliant and absolutely 100% accurate. Like you hear about these crazy things that people, you know, on Twitter, they're getting like, you know, or TikTok or Instagram reels, right? Like there's these clips of people saying crazy things related to religion, but it's those crazy things that obviously it's hyperbolic to get to a point of like a holy war, right? But it's not so far-fetched to see how those dots connect. And it's only possible because of our attitudes towards that.
Yeah, and I think there's like a similarity in the visual language too between like these scenes where all the Fremen are gathered. And there we have one where it's like the amount of people, it's just unbelievable, the amount of people that you see, and they're just kind of waiting in the middle of it. And then you compare that to these scenes with the Harkonnens and like the almost Nazi-like imagery of like, we're in the black and white and all
the whole Fade Routh like military march after he's given. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, it's almost like it's revealing to you, well, how different is this place that Paul finds himself in, right? Like maybe at a certain point you wanted to sort of empathize with the Fremen and everything, because they've been put upon, they're the indigenous people of the land. But now when you're seeing this sort of same sort of fanaticism, it's like, is this just what power comes with, right? Like, is there any way that you can become a leader, that you can stand for what is right, whatever, you know, without this army of people behind you who, you know, believe in you to a terrifying degree to some level.
Yeah. I don't know if the film or the books have the answer to that, but religious fanaticism bad, I think.
The fact that we're sitting here talking about these ideas with a blockbuster action movie is great. Is, you know, that's exactly what I want. I think the performances you've shouted out are great shouts. You know, I do like Austin Butler's performance a lot. He's going pretty wild with it.
We can't say he's going hog wild, but he's going something wild, whatever the Dune hog equivalent is.
I will say I certainly didn't go, that's it, after the fight, or like during the fight scene. But I, you know, hearing some of these things about like, yo, he's the next Heath Ledger and all this stuff, I'm like, okay, like, I first of all, he doesn't appear more until like an hour and a half into
that's what
the movie.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like, he's just not the role of Fade Rautha, frankly, bigger in the film than it is in the book. And it's just not the same kind of, like, he can't be that because the level of the character is just not, it's not allowed to be that. And that's fine.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think that was, you know, the expectations I had were subverted because, you know, spoiler alert. I mean, I don't know what happens after this, so I shouldn't say spoiler alert.
Well, I'm not sure that what happened, that anyone really knows what's happening after this, because this is a spoiler. Like, the end of the film, not the end of the book. The Holy War, that has not happened in the book.
Okay.
A different flavor it happens in the book. He does not start a war with the Great Houses in the book at any point ever.
Okay.
And so that is a very big change. So I have no idea what they're doing with Dune Messiah.
But, you know, Fade Rautha shows up. He's talked about, like, oh, he's the psychopath, whatever. Yeah, we see some of that. He's, you know, slapping people around. But he goes in the arena. He fights these last members of the Atreides household or whatever. And
the slaves that they have.
Basically. He gets upset because they didn't drug them. And it's like, well, how intimidating really is this guy if he's having to, you know, fight drugged fighters in the arena? Yeah. And so it just, it's not necessarily a complaint. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's just, it was totally different from what I was expecting. Totally different from, I think, the way that people are talking about it. And I think it's a great performance, but you have to expect that it's just, this is the, you know, he's sort of the temporary villain of this movie, right? Like, the spoiler I was going to say is by the end, Paul kills him, right? Or, I mean, again, that's what it seems like in this fight.
You may learn in Dune Messiah that no one's ever truly gone.
Yeah. Well, again, that's why I couched what I was saying. But so maybe I will go back on this when the next movie comes out. But, you know, it's not what you think it's going to be. And I don't think that's a bad thing. It's just, you know, something worth pointing out. And then, Rebecca Ferguson, I think, is great. You know, the development of her character is really strong. As the first movie, it's like, you know, you're kind of like, what's all this Bene Gesserit, you know, stuff about, really? Like,
what's all this hogwash?
Yeah, well, you know, is this just like a mother, you know, trying to help her son realize his potential, right?
And part of it is that.
Yeah. Which is not inherently a bad thing.
That potential is just scary, you know?
Again, they're the protagonist, right? Where their family is killed. They're, you know, you're behind them. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, where exactly are we going with this? Right. Because she drinks the water of life. She becomes the Reverend Mother, but she comes out and explicitly says, well, I'm really only doing this because we need to stick around here. Right. Like, we need to embrace the prophecy if we're going to be safe, if we're going to get the power that we want to get what we want. And the way that we see that maybe she's sort of manipulating Paul, certainly manipulating the Fremen for her own personal desires is great. I think Rebecca Ferguson, you know, creates a challenging character here, which is what Lady Jessica is.
And I think the whole point that you were just, the way that you just phrased it really, really clicked something in my head, talking about like her personal desires. And I think the question that the film and the character sort of asks is like, what are her personal desires? Are her, like, because I'm sure she believes her personal desire hasn't changed, right? Like, her personal desire is for Paul to realize his potential to be safe. But, you know, that sort of the motherly instincts that she feels that were not passive, but were like a little bit more reserved because of the position that she was in the first book, you know, being, you know, deferential to Leto Atreides, her not husband, but to simplify, her husband. She's technically his concubine, not his wife, but that doesn't matter. You know, I think that the fact that that's like that sort of motherly instinct almost like accelerates in, like, Paul can't make these decisions for himself, and so she's trying to force his hand in these decisions and compel him to do these things. And I think the sort of, it's not such an explicit question, but I think this sort of like thematic question of you know, at a very basic level, like how far a mother will go, how far a mother will push their child to be the best that they can be, in air quotes. Mm-hmm. I think that that's like a really, it's a more like secondary or even tertiary question of the film, but obviously that's like critical to her character. And I think that's like really, like the fact that, again, to what you said earlier, like we're talking about this in this big action movie is like kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a degree of selfishness about it, right? Because she wants to be the Reverend Mother. She wants to hold this power. And more than that, she wants to be the person who gave birth to the Kwisatz Haderach, right? She wants to be this, you know.
There's a level of hubris involved, right? And yeah. And the Reverend Mother, Mohiam, who is the one we see with Florence Pugh and with the Emperor and in the first film. Yes, Charlotte Rampling's character. She, I think you maybe don't appreciate the level of hubris that she identifies in Lady Jessica until this book, right? Where she identifies that, like, we told you to only have a daughter, mm-hmm. but you had a son. Like that is, and we see that in this with Leia Seydoux's character, that those things are choices made by the Bene Gesserit when they are sort of conceiving a child. And I think it's only now that you appreciate the level of hubris that required for her to defect in that way, to believe that she could bear this, you know, this Kwisatz Haderach. I think she's a brilliant character. I think she really is.
Yeah. And hitting the other cast members, you know, really quickly, you know, I do think
We should talk about Zendaya. We have Zendaya. Yeah.
I mean, I think she's really good, right? Like as sort of the very earnest, She's the woke one, right, among the Fremen. She is like, I'm not buying into these prophecies and all of
these Gen Z woke liberals. God damn it.
And, you know, she does kind of wear her heart on her sleeve, which you know, I thought Zendaya does all of that very well. You know, she finds herself connected to Paul and with genuine feelings for him. You know, maybe the romance, you know, it's probably
is
not
that one of your nits? Is that
best one of your handled nits? Part of the movie? Yeah, it is. But
the tough thing, and I think this is the best time to start talking about it. The tough thing and one of the major differences between the book and the film is there is a multi-year time jump in the book that obviously does not happen in the movie. The movie takes place over probably like 4 or 5 months at most. And because like Lady Jessica has not given birth yet in the film or in the book, she has given birth to Aaliyah is the name of her daughter. Anya Taylor-Joy's character.
This is going to be Anya Taylor-Joy.
This is Anya Taylor-Joy's character. Yeah. And the relationships that we're talking about here, although not necessarily always explicitly shown the development in the book, some parts are, but there is time for these things to have matured in a way that is a little bit more sensible maybe than the timeline that we see on the screen in the film. And I would agree that the sort of acceleration of the relationship between Chani and Paul in the movie does feel like one of the parts where like maybe it's a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a banana peel, but it's like there's a little bit of friction in the two things. What I will say is that from the character side of Paul, I think the immersion into this like relationship makes a lot of sense because he's been having all these like really confusing visions and dreams about her. And obviously he's like a boy at the beginning of the film still in this in way over his head. Like obviously he's very capable. His fighting skills are superb. I mean, we see him kill Jamis at the end of the first movie. And he holds his own in a lot of ways. But the Chani side is the more confusing part, which I think is the direction you were going. But I do think that is like one unfortunate side effect of one of the adaptive choices, which otherwise I think is really a really good adaptive choice because, Scott, we do not want a 1.5-year-old child capable of talking and full movement and adult functionality on the screen in this movie. I promise you, we do not want that. That would really break, I think, the seriousness of the film.
Robert Zemeckis is hearing this and he's like, oh, I have some ideas.
Yeah, no, I keep those people away from our Dune is what I say. because I just think it works in the novel medium, right? It works in a book. I can't picture a world in which it fits with the tone of the movie.
Yeah, I just think that the romance, you know.
Yeah.
We're talking about a lot of big, weighty themes and everything, and sure. It just feels like a little bit trivial amidst all of that. And I do find it to be a powerful moment. Like, it is probably one of my favorite shots at the end after Paul has defeated Fader Alpha and the Fremen and everyone all bow basically to
and she stays standing
to worship him. And the only two people who are standing are Irulan and Chani, and Paul is like right in between them. And it's like, maybe it's very obvious imagery, but it's like, okay, here we go. You know, like he's caught between these two paths, right? Do you embrace the power? Do you embrace the myth? Do you marry Princess Irulan? Because this is the path to, peace and power.
Paradise.
Yeah, paradise, exactly.
Yeah, not peace, that's for sure.
but that is what they have in mind. They say, oh, this is going to bring peace, but...
narrator voice, it doesn't.
Or do you choose, you follow your heart, right? Like you go with Chani and risk losing this sort of, influence and everything that you've built for yourself. And I think that's good. It's just some of the it ends up with Chani just sort of storming out. And it's like, well, is she storming out because, of this whole power thing? Or is she storming out because she has a crush on him and now he's going to marry somebody else, right? It's like, I know.
Isn't it both?
Yeah. And like, I can't fault the movie too much because it's like, okay, she's still, I guess she's still meant to be not a teenager, but a young person at the very least. And so she still, has these sort of naked emotions, if you will, when it comes to these sort of things. But yeah, if I had to pick some very minor nits, like it is one thing that like there are some moments where it just seems a little trivial compared to everything else that's going on.
Yeah. Chani this is the character that is the most different between the book and the movie. I was lucky enough to hear Villeneuve talk about this. So I will share some of his thoughts that he shared on it, is that he really wanted to use Chani as the medium by which the audience will more explicitly see how uncomfortable some of the stuff that Paul is doing is and should be. One of the complaints isn't the right word, but sort of one of the reactions to the novel in the 60s when Frank Herbert first wrote it was not what he had expected. He expected a reaction that more questioned and sort of acknowledged the concern around the sort of like idea of religious fanaticism and messianic religion and things like that. That wasn't really something that the cultural consensus at the time really latched onto out of the book. And that is something that he tried to correct in Dune Messiah. And told a very different story with much more explicit themes around the negativity of that. And Villeneuve, as I think is clear by the level of care that he's brought to adapting the Dune, like he wanted to bring forward some of those more explicit themes that sort of highlight the negativity of what's happening. And he does that in several different ways, not just with Chani, but Chani was sort of wanted to be sort of the he wanted her to be almost like the audience stand in as you witness Paul do these like really terrible start to do these like really terrible things and do them in a way that like the good guys are winning, if you want to do like the most surface of surface reads, but at what cost are they winning, so to speak. And I think that Chani is one of the mediums by which he tries to channel that, because she's a little bit more of a passive character in the book. And again, the whole relationship is a bit different. Just to sort of highlight how the emotional stakes are a bit different in the book. She and Paul have a child during that time gap that exists in the book. And that child is killed in by like one of the Harkonnen either raids or is killed in one of the battles. I'm forgetting the very specific detail right now. And then, so the emotional stakes are a little bit more invested. And then I think obviously you don't get that level of emotional stakes in the movie because they haven't been together that long and they haven't had a child. And I find the ending really interesting because Chani's dedication to Paul is like never really wavers in the book. Especially even in Messiah, when things start to question, even when Paul is like not being a good partner for her, because I guess just to clarify some things, the notion of having like a wife and like a mistress slash concubine is like not foreign in this world. And that will be like, at least in the book, that is what the setup for, like, Paul is married to Princess Irulan. He is like the emperor of the dynasty, true. But Chani is his concubine and Chani is the person who he has children with, not Irulan. And obviously that creates tension that is explored. It's no secret there. That is a point of tension, no doubt. But the fact that Chani is sort of fleeing Arakeen at the end of the film and fleeing Paul, I think sets up a very, like, how will that affect their relationship going into Dune Part 3? Because that's not what happens in the book. Again, I sort of already highlighted that the sort of end with the holy war happens in the series. Don't get me wrong. Just going to war with the great houses doesn't necessarily happen at the end of the first book. And so there's a lot of questions for how Villeneuve might approach Part 3 and Messiah. But I think Chani is like a really interesting change in development going into that, because I think her, the way that she acts throughout the film, the way that Zendaya performs that throughout the film, it does have this sort of raw emotion to it. I think that's sort of what you highlighted there before is exactly right. And it makes sense that she'd be running away out of a little bit of heartbreak at the end. But I think that she's also genuinely disgusted several times, you know, in the second half of the film with Paul's choices once they go south, even though in the second viewing, especially I right before they go south, she's like, you know, she has some conversation with him where the spirit is, the world is forcing us to do these things we don't want to do, and I'll always be with you as long as you don't change. And I think what we see in the last third of the film is that in her eyes and in ours, Paul dramatically changes who he is and the lengths at which he is willing to go for power and for revenge and for all these things. And I think that her reaction at the end of the film is just as much a reaction to learning that, you know, her beloved is going to marry this princess, and also what Paul has done and how he has done it. And I think that that's ultimately why the character, although I think there is maybe some shortcoming, I don't even disagree with the stuff you're saying around the shortcomings around how the emotional relationship develops, but ultimately the character like does really work for me at the end of the film.
Oh, and for me too. Yeah. Again, minor things, but it's, and you know, the whole, I he says like, I'm going to love you till I,
as long as I breathe. Breathing.
Yeah.
As long as but, I breathe.
Yeah. It's complicated because he like stops breathing right at one point after drinking the water of life.
Oh yeah.
And that's a good point. Has to be revived by her. Right. And it's like,
yeah. Desert spring, tears of desert spring.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, well you're breathing again, but like when you stopped breathing, did that also stop this part of you? I feel like that's maybe something, because after he wakes up from this is when he really, you know, leans heavily in.
Well, because he's drunk the water of life.
And
this is something that it's not I mean, it's kind of glossed over, but like what that does is it allows him the memories of all of the Reverend Mothers that have come before him. So he has this whole vast knowledge and this notion of that with his exposure to spice and his heightened sensitivity to these vision, like these Bene Gesserit powers, this opens his mind to be able to see the future. I think this is one of the brilliant parts of the adaptation. And I don't know how much you caught none of this. This is one of the reasons why I think everyone should absolutely watch the first Dune movie within a week of seeing Part 2, because there are direct recreations of scenes that were Paul's visions in the first film that are slightly different to sort of highlight how his visions were not exactly correct. One of the ones that I think is maybe the easiest to catch is, because this was in the trailer for the first movie a bunch, is the scene where he's fighting in this sort of like gilded armor. Do you know the one I'm talking about, where he's like fighting these Harkonnens and gilded armor? He's like rolling around. He cuts the person and he looks into the camera.
Yeah.
Shawnee has that exact shot in this movie, in the final battle. Mm-hmm. And that's like one example of this film and the sort of level of intricately tying things together that Villeneuve and John Spates are trying to do in the film. And that's like the most obvious example in terms of the visions. But another one is like, you know, I recognize your footsteps, old man, like that vision of Gurney Halleck, you know, Josh Brolin, who we haven't even talked about really at all. And I think that there's like that level of attention to detail in the film as it relates to Paul's visions and how they're clouded and inaccurate in before he takes the water of life, and how we are told that they become accurate after. We don't see some of those visions, I don't think, in the movie, unless I'm misremembering, but it's like there's this final hurdle for him to have like clear prescience into the future.
Other than, I guess, that he sees that, I mean, it's not really a vision, it's just like a realization, but that he sees that Baron Harkonnen is his uncle now. Or grandfather.
But he sees that after he drinks the water of life.
Yeah.
And that's because he has the memories of Reverend Mothers in the past.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot going on there. I will say, you know, sort of still talking about some of the people we haven't talked about.
Sure.
Another nitpick for me, again, I hesitate to even say that because
silence.
I just think it's the way that the character has to be, but Raban, Dave Bautista's character, really doesn't have anything to do except be a buffoon, right? And just walk around just yelling at people.
A lot. And the fact that he's like a scared little boy when he actually comes face to face with Paul after the attack on the Spice Depot is kind of brilliant.
Yeah, but it is a little bit one note, I guess, is my point. But he gets his just desserts from Gurney in the end.
I think it's fair to say, if we're just talking about one note, the Harkonnens in general are one note characters.
Sure,
I don't think we need to hide the eight ball on that. They're not some deeply nuanced, complex villains. Yeah. They are evil.
And that's why I hesitate to say it's a nit, because it is, it's just kind of who they are, but. You mentioned Josh Brolin as Gurney. You know, he doesn't have a ton to do here, but I think he's a fun character, right? He is something that ties Paul to
his past,
his former life, right? Yeah. Like back to his home in Arakeen and you know, with the Atreides family.
I think this character is so interesting. He doesn't get a lot of screen time in the movie, but the timing of his appearance and his relationship with Paul, like you feel him pulling Paul, like almost sort of like the opposite of Chani, right? Like Chani and him are almost sitting on two ends of the spectrum in the directions that they're trying to pull Paul while he remains in the north after his mother goes south, because he wants Paul to like take the family atomics, like hit back directly at Arakeen. Like, you did this with 200 men. Imagine what you could do with the millions that are in the South. And I find this sort of like this connection to his past life, this reminder that he owes revenge to these people, right? Like you must take vengeance because you are the one who is able to. And that sort of like devil on the shoulder, so to speak, if Chani is the angel, is, we don't get that balance for very long in the film, but it's something that I really quite liked. And you can see how Paul immediately sort of reacts to having Gurney back in his life again. He's, rather than spending time with the Fremen at camp at night, he's like sitting on top of the dune talking to Gurney instead. And you sort of feel that distance almost immediately start to appear between him and Chani more directly, but also him and the Fremen a little bit. Like, some of this is already happening, but he describes his relationship as evolving to Gurney as they used to be friends, now they're followers. And I think you start to see that gap appear even more and more as he spends more time with Gurney and less time with the Fremen. And I think that we don't get a lot of time with that, but the glimpses of how that evolves Paul's relationship with the Fremen, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, and this doesn't even really have anything to do with the character, but there is one of my favorite shots when he first appears and is just walking, you know, forward into the desert.
Yeah.
No, not even that. He's just walking forward, and all of the Fremen, including Paul, just emerge from the sand, pop right out of the sand.
Yeah,
it's a sick shot.
Yeah. Speaking of cool shots, how about Harkonnen, who gets shot by a rocket and explodes on the side?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, like I laughed out loud when that happened. I mean, he got
I whooped. And when I saw it for the first time at Lincoln Center, I was like, oh,
absolutely wrecked.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was pretty great. But yeah, no, I mean the fight scenes. I think we're about to get into wrap up here. But the fight scenes, the action scenes. I mean, they're so kinetic.
Unbelievable. They're unbelievable.
Immersive. Yeah. I mean, and maybe this could even transition. Like, my favorite scene probably that we haven't talked about is when Paul calls the Shai-Hulud, calls the worm, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Tames, rides, whatever you want to call it, the worm for the first time.
He rides
time.
The worm, as we all do at one point in our life. We ride the worm, yeah.
Amazing. Just like the wall of sand and noise and everything that just like envelops you as
call a big one.
And as he just, stares it down, stands it down.
There's like it's not a tracking shot, but like when there's like the landscape shot with him in the foreground and the worm sign in the background, and he's like walking back and forth and the camera pans with him and then it pans back, and I'm like, Greg Cook, baby, let's go.
And another shot I love is like when the spice harvesters are there and the Fremen are like running in between like the wheels and like spice harvester and everything. It's like, again, it's so sick. Yeah. Anything else you want to add, Scott? I mean, we kind of just talked about the characters and everything, but we really got into, I think
we hit most, if not all the themes just by talking about the characters. Yeah. The only thing that would be left is just talking more about the action sequences, which I'm glad you did. I think the production value. See, I'm glad I mentioned Gaty Prime at the top because we didn't end up talking about Gaty Prime. Even though it's like a show, sort of like gladiatorial celebration fight, like, again, I'm just sort of like totally taken away by this immersion in Gaty Prime with the Black Sun, with all of that. Like, I think that's incredible. I think that the action set pieces, I sort of mentioned the one at the top where, I guess it's not, you rightly pointed out, it's not technically the first scene in the movie because we do have that scene with Princess Irulan and her diary entry. But that scene, I think you don't fully appreciate in the first film what the Fremen are capable of, like truly what they're capable of from a combat perspective. And then that scene very quickly shows you that they're not just a bunch of desert people with, knives. They've got guns. They have Harkonnen technology that they've been stealing over the years. And they just destroy these like Harkonnen troops with rifle, like with their own technology, basically. And I think that that is like a really brilliant sort of reminder that the Fremen are not some like weak people to be preyed upon. Like, they are very much the predators on this world. And they only grow in power as the Harkonnens send these troops into the desert with technology. And that technology is taken by the Fremen. And so I liked that introductory scene. Yeah, all the spice harvester scenes are like awesome. The final big climactic battle. I mean, we got to talk about the worms, Scott. We got to talk about the riding three worms into battle. Just the general, all the riding the worm stuff. I know that I know that there's a lot of CGI in that scene. Don't get me wrong. Like, I know that's not a real worm that they're riding out in Jordan in the desert. But I think that it's so. The shot, anytime there's an overhead shot in this movie, you sort of alluded to the scene earlier on where Paul is like wading his way through the crowd to go inside to like the sort of religious council or whatever scene, a scene that we only very briefly talked about, which is the sort of like Timothy's big scene. Yeah. Timothy Chalamet's big scene.
That would be my other favorite scene probably.
Yeah. 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 But there's an overhead shot when they decide to ride south where there's just a bunch of worms just like riding through the desert. Uh-huh. I'm just like, damn, that's so cool. That's just so cool. And then, yeah, at the end of the film when Stilgar and his Fremen, sort of the northern Fremen, are riding three worms and like eating a bunch of the Sardaukar, I'm just like, we're so back. Right after they like nuke. Are those nukes that he uses?
I was going to say, the other part of the whole technology thing you're saying, I think, is like, yeah, the Fremen are definitely not, you know, the good guys, if you will. We're using, they're literally described as warheads, I believe, by Gurney. Like
the family Atomics.
The Atreides family warheads.
Where are your family warheads stored, Scott?
They're very, very not subtly, you know, invoking the name of like nuclear weapons, basically.
I mean, yeah, you think about, you know, these also like these, the year is 10,191. Like, you know, I think we forget how far in the future this is supposed to be set. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. All right, Scott, it may be a tough task, but what's your favorite senior moment from Dune?
I don't know, man. How am I supposed to choose? What are you making me do this for?
Well, I've chosen two. I've shouted out two there that I really.
So what were you? So yeah. So you, officially, your favorite is either which
Paul,
one?
Paul riding the worm for the first time, and then his big scene where he just sort of, you know, you realize he's all the way in.
He shoots a shot.
As far as he's embracing this, and he's about to lead everyone into this fight with the Emperor and everything.
Yeah, I think for me, one of my favorite like images in the film, I think I often come back to images when I talk about like favorite scenes or moments. It is the overhead shot of him wading through this crowd. I think you really feel the weight. And I think this comes right after. There's a shot that I believe is right before this, where he's sort of like emerging out of the desert from like a soft focus with like sand, like I think like worms like shooting like out of the sand behind him. You know what shot I'm talking about, where it's like the horizon's very high on the shot and he's like walking out of focus towards the
maybe
camera.
I mean, it's I've only seen it the one time still, so
yeah. So there's like a shot that then transitions into him, like I think it's back to back or roughly close to each other, and then the shot where he's like wading through the bodies. And I think this is such a stark, like this really reminds you and emphasizes and doubles down on the fact that he's entered this world, especially because he's taken the water of life now, I believe. Like he's a different person now. Yeah. It's not that he didn't have this popularity in the north, but you never see him wading through thousands of bodies in the north. You don't see him worshipped, like basically being worshipped in this way in the north. That people may be followers of his, but they're not like that. And that's one of my favorite scenes. I also think that as much as Rabin is not given a lot of airtime or space to be a real character, I do think that his sort of furious flight into the desert to try to catch the Fremen, to catch Paul after the spice depot is destroyed, like that whole scene when he's on the ornithopter is like hilarious, when he just sort of like breaks the guy's neck after he like loses him and then just tells him to fire on the rock and then jumps out. And not that Dune, I mean, there are certainly horror elements to Dune, but this whole notion of like they're like walking through the kicked up sand and debris that they can't see anything and they're being slowly picked off one by one is just like a great ending. Obviously he flees. And
when he sees
would have been killed by one of the Fremen, if not for the rifle of someone on the ornithopter that he boards. But yeah, I mean, it's so hard to pick these scenes. I very easily would. I mean, definitely the scene that you're talking about with Chalamet in the sort of religious council where he takes his spot as the sort of leader of the Fremen is definitely an outstanding scene. I think I probably would have taken that as one if you hadn't. But just to talk about something different.
Yeah, let's put a score on it. What do you give Dune Part 2 out of 10?
It's 10. There's no reason to mince words about it. The first Dune was a 10. This film's a 10. I try not to think too far ahead about these things, and we'll see when Dune Part 3 comes out. I mean, there's supposed to be, in theory, if you follow the book's narrative, like a 17 to 20 year time jump between the two movies. I don't think it's clear that that will necessarily happen. I mean, we'll see. And we'll see how they choose to do that with the time gap and representing people's age. Like, obviously, they've seemed to have cast Anya Taylor-Joy for his sister, for Paul's sister. But like, how long will they wait, or will they just use makeup to age up Paul or things like that? I think that's curious where that will go. But we'll see if we get Dune Part 3 this decade. And even if we do not, it will be the only thing it ever had to be. And that is the Dune Part 1 and Dune Part 2 being one of the great movies, probably one of the best movies of the 2020s. So,
yeah, it's probably a 10. I'm giving it a 9.7 for now until I rewatch it. It's, you know, as recent blockbusters go, I can't think of many that even come close to touching it. It's a spectacular. Yeah,
there's this really funny tweet that I don't know if you saw going around yesterday that were like, obviously, like, dude, total dude tweet, by the way. But it's like, these four movies have defined the 2020s so far. And it's like Top Gun, Maverick, Dune Part 2, Avatar, The Way of Water, and Oppenheimer. And someone like QRT'd that and said like Earth, Fire, Air, Water. And I was like, oh my God, we're so back. I mean, honestly though, like what a, not that other decades don't have their own like treats of blockbusters, but the fact that we've been gifted the imagery and the epicness at scale of not just like action blockbusters, but also like sci-fi, like Avatar, The Way of Water, this film, Nope. Like, these are films that are just like truly amazing, like sci-fi action movies. And it's like, it feels like it's incredible that we are basically a third of the way through the decade. And I guess a little bit more technically. So like, we're 4 years and a couple months into the decade, and we've been given probably like if you include Dune Part 1, 4 action, like sci-fi action films that sort of rank up there in like an all-time conversation around like what the great sci-fi action films are specifically. And I don't know, it's like, not to get like super earnest and like, you know, about it all, but like, it's, you got to wonder like how many more of these types of movies are we going to be gifted with, you know, in the next 4 or 5 years? And again, they'll exist, don't get me wrong, but it feels really special to have all these movies.
Yeah. We're very blessed, for sure. We are very blessed.
And of course, I forgot to say my beloved Tenet, which I rewatched this week as well.
Of course.
Guys, the redemption arc on Tenet, we are so fucking back. Unbelievable that people are acting like they were there in 2020 with me in the theater.
I was there.
I know you were. But all these people on Twitter saying that like Tenet's amazing. Like, I saw you all in 2020. You weren't there. You weren't there in the trenches with me.
Okay. Well, to be fair, going to the theater had some risks associated with
it. Yeah. And I took those risks for my beloved Tenet.
And I did too. But
yeah, I know.
2 days in a row, as we recall. But
an amazing story. A truly amazing story that we've told many times on the podcast. So.
All right, Scott, that should do it for our review of Dune Part 2. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we have our final award season update before the Oscars. We're going to hit the final Guild Awards, including the Screen Actors Guild, Producers Guild, and Directors Guild Awards. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Back to this episode of Some Like It, Scott. Scott, as mentioned before the break, we're going to hit the final award season updates before the Academy Awards. And that means we have the final Guild Awards. We'll start with sort of the chalk, which is the Producers and Directors Guild Awards. Scott, Oppenheimer being the big winner at both of these, Christopher Nolan taking home the top prize at the Directors Guild Awards. The Producers Guild Awards, best film going to Oppenheimer as well. This just sort of further cementing, I think, that it is going to be the big winner next Sunday night at the Academy Awards. Christopher Nolan is going to get his first Oscar. So, but Oppenheimer, the big winner, you know, the Producers Guild tracking closely with Best Picture. It's one of the most closely related, I think, of all the precursors, like in terms of what wins the PGA, pretty much always wins Best Picture. So,
yeah. And another thing related to that is, like, I think we even saw that this year, like the nominees at the PGA are pretty much always the nominees at the Oscars. So to your point, it has a very good track record.
It's interesting, you know, because a lot of times, even in recent years, these races have kind of had twists and turns, but there's been no twists and turns really through award season. It's been Oppenheimer full steam ahead all the way. And yeah, I mean, that's what we're going to see next Sunday. I'm pretty confident of that. Scott, we also had the Screen Actors Guild Awards, which, again, sort of providing some guidance for who might win the major acting awards at the Oscars, mainly because the actors are all put into, you know, the same category. The, you know, there's no genre designations like there are at the Golden Globes. So, you know, we finally get to see Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone paired against each other. We finally get to see Cillian Murphy and Paul Giamatti against each other. And those, I think, were the two races that we are interested in watching, because it seems very sewn away that Robert Downey Jr. and Davine Joy Randolph are going to win the supporting awards. But we now have, you know, perhaps a better clue on the lead acting awards. Lily Gladstone does beat out Emma Stone in the Best Actress category, and in the Best Actor category, it went to Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer over Paul Giamatti in the Holdovers. You know, I think we were kind of wondering if things might be leaning towards Paul Giamatti after some of the other awards shows, but I think this cements that Cillian Murphy will be the favorite at the Oscars. I would not be stunned if Paul Giamatti still finds a way to come out on top. I would not be stunned if Emma Stone still finds a way to come out on top.
I would say Emma Stone has a better chance than Paul Giamatti, if just in terms of my belief in her ability to sort of break the narrative, so to speak.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, I'm perfectly happy with both of these choices. I think I haven't seen Poor Things, but I think Lily Gladstone is among the best performances of last year. So I definitely want to see her get her flowers over Emma Stone, who's already had hers. And then, yeah, Paul Giamatti and Cillian Murphy, both great performances. But if I had to make the choice, I would go with Cillian Murphy as well for what he did in Oppenheimer. So, I think we kind of know what to expect now at the Oscars. You know, of course, we're still looking forward to watching it, I'm sure, but I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of suspense in what is to come.
I think that there's still enough suspense on the acting side. I'd say both in lead actor and lead actress, there's more suspense than last year, where like the most contested race might have been Michelle Yeoh up against Kate Blanchett. Although even that was like, that felt even more clearly tied up than some of these things by the time the Oscars rolled around.
Yeah. I will give a brief shout out to the Indy Spirit Awards, which also happened. Scott, I don't know if you saw that, but Past Lives was the big winner on the evening. Best Picture and Best Director going to Celine Song for Past Lives. Also, Anatomy of a Fall winning Best International Film. The acting awards, they break it up by Best Lead Performance and Best Supporting Performance. So they don't distinguish it by gender. Jeffrey Wright won the Best Lead Performance for American Fiction. Court Jefferson also got a screenplay award. It was Best New Screenplay or Best First Screenplay. And in the Supporting Performance Award, Davine Joy Randolph winning for The Holdovers. So, you know, just kind of continuing her steamrolling through award season. So those are your big winners there. I always enjoy the Indie Spirit Awards. They tend to reward some different films, although most of the movies that they rewarded this year are all Oscar-nominated movies. One thing that I was really excited to see is that Daniel Garber won Best Film Editing for How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which I think is one of the best edited movies from last year. So glad to see that movie get a shout out. And of course, Kelly Reichardt also accepted the John Cassavetes Award for showing up, which was a nice moment as well for a giant figure in indie cinema.
Sammy Birch won for Best First Screenplay. Cord Jefferson won for Best Screenplay.
Best Screenplay, right. Okay. Yeah, no, that's right, because that's what triggered me thinking about the Indie Spirit Awards, was thinking about the Screenplay Awards. And yeah, that May, December winning there. So Sammy Birch did get some recognition, which is certainly more than, I mean, she is nominated for the Oscar. But again, it felt like sort of a throwaway, throwing May, December a bone to give it the one nomination. Don't expect it to win.
Dominic Sessa won Best Breakthrough Performance.
He did, yes, which kind of a no-brainer. I'm not sure who else was nominated. I guess maybe Abby Ryder Fortson might have been nominated. But
no, Marshawn Lynch.
Yes, that's right. I forgot about that.
Everyone else are people that I have not heard of.
Yeah. All right, Scott. Well, that should do it for this episode of Some Like It. Scott, where can our listeners find you on social media?
At @Shelton2013.
And I am at Scarvy Dent on all platforms. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have and you'd like to support us, don't forget about our Patreon page at patreon.com/mediaplugpods. But even if you can't support us over there, don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, like, do all of the things that you do on your preferred podcast app. And we hope that you'll be back for our next episode, on which we will be recapping all of the highs and lows from the 96th Academy Awards. But until then, for Scott Shelton, I'm Scott Harvey. We'll see you down the road.